This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight. The use of military to enforce quarantine is causing anxiety in some African countries who fear conflict. Libya's Khalifa Haftar promises to cease hostilities during the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. And campaigning for Burundi's presidential election officially starts this week. These stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. The use of militaries to enforce quarantines in order to prevent the spread of coronavirus is causing anxiety among some in African countries who fear conflict. VOA Salem Salomon takes a look at the risks and the benefits of deploying security forces during a pandemic.
South African President Cyril Ramaphosa has ordered the deployment of 73,000 soldiers to enforce a lockdown in the country's fight against the coronavirus. The move is unprecedented in the modern history of the country.
Your mission is mission save lives. You are required to go out and save the lives of the 57 million South Africans who live within the borders of our country.
Across Africa, security forces are being called upon to seal borders, enforce quarantines, and maintain order. The measures are viewed with mixed emotions on a continent where, throughout history, military and police forces have been used to control the civilian population instead of protect them. There have already been instances of violence. On April 12, soldiers from the South African National Defense Force were accused of beating a man to death in Alexandra, north of Johannesburg. He was the ninth person killed in April by South African security forces, according to local reports. In Rwanda, police shot and killed two people while on patrol, enforcing a lockdown. In Kenya, police raided a shantytown in Nairobi and killed a 13-year-old. In Nigeria, the National Human Rights Commission reported that security forces killed 18 people in 2 weeks while enforcing restrictions on movement. John Siko, a director at a security consultant firm based in Dubai, said most militaries on the African continent are not trained in maintaining public order. Infantry training that teaches soldiers to subdue an enemy or retake a position could have tragic consequences when applied to a civilian population.
How many places are even sending guys into squatter camps or other informal settlements around the continent, potentially with live rounds? It doesn't take much to set off a real disaster here.
Siko said security forces need more training for missions that may require crowd control or other duties. Some militaries within the continent and with extensive peacekeeping experience create mock villages with paid actors to test the restraint of soldiers before they are deployed.
I think it just speaks to the need that across the continent there's a great deal of desire and necessity for public order training to make sure that guys can respond in a human rights respective manner when this does happen.
Dr. Cyrus Shapar agrees. He's a physician and director of the Prevent Epidemics team at a global public health organization with operations in Africa. He said the military has certain capabilities that could be useful when deployed in coordination with public health and medical systems.
Most militaries, when they get involved in disasters, do things like natural disasters. They're not so well trained on, say, infectious disease events, because these can actually affect the people responding as well. So it's important that that training is in place if the military is going to get involved to protect the military too, that they understand the risks of them getting involved in an infectious disease event. And that's all based in science.
Siko said that foreign training often focuses on the military, but assistance is also needed to help the gendarmes and police forces most often called upon to interact with civilians.
I think the next few weeks are going to be quite critical. And again, unfortunately, I do think it's a bit too late for Western or donor responses to have much impact here. But again, it has to be strategic. Longer term, this is something that I think Washington, the administration and others need to really be considering moving forward.
Salem Solomon, VOA News, Washington.
Khalifa Haftar, the commander of the self-proclaimed Libyan National Army, says his forces will cease hostilities for the Muslim holy month of Ramadan in response to international calls for a humanitarian truce due to the coronavirus pandemic. Haftar's rival, the UN-recognized Government of National Accord, has yet to respond. Haftar agreed to this truce yesterday as international criticism mounts over his earlier claim that he accepted a popular mandate to rule the country. VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi spoke with Rhiannon Smith, managing editor of the London-based Libya Analysis, about chances for the health system to benefit from the truce to deal with a possible outbreak of coronavirus and the expected humanitarian crisis in the war-torn country.
Even prior to this latest escalation, the public health situation in Libya was already very poor. The health sector is largely underfunded, understaffed, has been under strain for many, many years. And so that is already an issue. Likewise, issues of kind of infrastructure, sanitation, basic supplies, all of these are things that Libya has been struggling with in recent months and years because of the ongoing violence since 2011. However, the recent escalation makes these problems even worse, not only because you have an increase in the amount of violence happening and therefore deaths and casualties from war and from bombings that are also putting a strain on the health system. You also have, we've had examples of different armed groups, for example, shutting off the water supply. So I think the first thing to note is that the public health situation in Libya was already be struggling to cope even without the current conflict and latest escalation. This is because Libya's health sector is severely underfunded, understaffed. The infrastructure is poor. We've also got ongoing issues with things like the oil blockade and issues with sanitation and other things like that. So with that, in addition to the escalation, things could really get a lot worse. And I think with the escalation, what we're seeing is people being forced out of their houses due to bombings and attacks, people being killed and injured, which is also overwhelming the health services. And, it's very difficult to implement things like curfews or social distancing and those type of efforts to try and prevent the virus when actually people are, fearing for their lives and having to often flee from their homes because of the ongoing fighting.
Recently, forces of the Government of National Accord, backed by Turkish drones and firepower, poised to gain the upper hand against General Haftar's Libyan National Army. Could the change in balance of power convince General Haftar and his regional supporters that there is no military solution in Libya?
If Haftar is forced to stop his push on Tripoli, if he really is forced onto the back foot military, as seems to be happening at the moment, then logically it would seem that he would be forced into a position where he may have to consider a political solution, to consider suing for peace or broken some kind of negotiation. However, what we've seen from Haftar in the past is that he really is very set on a military solution that kind of half measures in his mind of a political kind of agreement are not going to be acceptable. So I think from his perspective, even if the LNA is forced to withdraw from Tripoli, I think we will see a regrouping, a change of the narrative, and an attempt to kind of restart this process maybe further down the line. However, importantly, I think this may be different for the regional supporters. So countries like the UAE, Saudi and Russia, they are the main forces kind of providing the arms and the funding and a lot of the expertise for the LNA forces and for this military operation. If it seems that this military operation is not going to succeed anytime soon and that it could take years and years to happen, then I think they will be a lot more reluctant to keep supporting that. And therefore, they may put pressure or just withdraw their support for the military operation. And that may force Haftar, even if he doesn't want to, look at other kind of non-military ways of finding a solution.
So what are the possible scenarios in Libya with the failure of the international community to take strong actions to stop the fighting and with the unsuccessful efforts by consecutive UN envoys to Libya?
Unfortunately, in the short term, I think the most likely situation to occur in any kind of scenario is that we are on the kind of brink of a humanitarian and economic crisis, that the country is no longer exporting oil. The oil price anyway internationally is very low currently. There's a lack of, you know, with the virus is likely to spread, the healthcare system is unlikely to be able to cope with that. So I think whatever happens, we're likely to see some kind of humanitarian crisis in the coming weeks. Increased division, maybe less fighting, but that will be mainly because both the kind of authorities are trying to fight the impacts of the virus, the economic crisis, and the likely humanitarian crisis.
That was Rhiannon Smith, managing editor of the London-based Libya Analysis, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. Burundi's presidential elections officially began this week. The last election in 2015 was marred by a coup attempt and a violent government crackdown. Rights activists warn Burundi's ruling party may commit abuses ahead of this year's election. For more, VOA's Jason Patinkin spoke to Amnesty International's Rachel Nicholson, who has been researching human rights in Burundi.
The CNL, its members have been targeted for attacks, particularly by the youth wing of the ruling party, the Imbonerakure, over some time now. Largely these attacks, they have been the destruction of the party buildings, physical attacks on members, it's been fights taking place, targeting of members who perhaps are not necessarily the most high profile members of the party, but people who come under pressure to leave the party and join the ruling party. Some of the most concerning incidents, of course, have been where the Imbonerakure have been alleged to have actually killed members of the CNL. You know, in some of those cases, of course, there are conflicting reports as to what exactly happened, whether it was a political conflict or whether it was a land conflict. That was the case last month with a local CNL representative who was shot dead.
You mentioned that there are conflicting reports about some of these incidents, and that brings up the issue of transparency, because it's very difficult to get verified information out of Burundi because the press, it seems, are also under attack.
Yes, the media has come under attack. Since the protests in 2015, many hundreds even of journalists had to flee the country. And so those few independent media houses that are still operating are under particular pressure. One notable case is the case of Iwachu Media House, and particularly their four journalists who are now serving a 2.5-year sentence, essentially because they were seeking to go and cover an armed attack that took place in Bubanza province in October, that they were arrested, prevented effectively from carrying out their interviews and reporting on what really had happened on the ground the night before.
And what about civil society?
Civil society has also come under attack since 2015. There's an ongoing court case against many members of the human rights community in exile who are accused of insurrection for their role in the protest movement. Other less known human rights defenders are also paying the price. Germaine Rukuki is a human rights defender who used to work for the anti-torture organization ACAT Burundi. After he'd stopped working for that organization, he was arrested and charged with threatening state security. And he's currently serving 32 years in prison, really on the grounds of his human rights work for when he used to work for that organization. It sends a very clear message that independent monitoring and reporting on the situation is not welcome in Burundi.
That was VOA's Jason Patinkin speaking with Amnesty International's Rachel Nicholson. VOA's Central Africa Service has spoken to four candidates in the presidential election. They say the political and security environment for the May vote is far better than in 2015, and they expect a fair, independent election. Independent candidate Didon Nduziwimana says that despite sporadic violence between the youth of the ruling party and the main opposition party CNL, the political and security environment in Burundi is reassuring. Current First Vice President Gaston Sindomwo, who is among the candidates, brushes off the criticism of international rights groups. However, he accuses the national radio and television stations of favoring the ruling party candidates. Abdul Kassim, the flag bearer for the UDP Inzigamibanga party, says he expects the elections to be fair and transparent. The candidate for the main opposition party, Agathon Rwasa, this week told VOA's Central African Service that he is optimistic that the election will be fair, but criticized the election commission for its performance and urged the government to see the attacks against his supporters stop. A court in Uganda has rejected bail for 19 members of the LGBT community who were arrested for gathering in public in violation of the coronavirus lockdown. Police arrested the men last month at a shelter for sexual minorities. Their lawyer argues the men, who range in age from 19 to 32, were targeted because of their sexual orientation. Halima Tumani reports from Kampala.
Lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender activists in Uganda have expressed concern over what they say is a deliberate violation of their community members' rights. On March 29th, police arrested 23 members of an LGBT shelter, the Children of the Sun Foundation, in the town of Chengera, 10 kilometers southwest of Kampala. Four of the men were released on medical grounds, while the others were presented to court and remanded to prison. On the day of the arrest, the local mayor was videotaped asking the men who their parents were and hitting one of them on the hands with a huge cane. The men were also made to face the camera to reveal their faces. On Tuesday, Adrian Juko, a lawyer for activist group Sexual Minorities Uganda, petitioned the High Court in Kampala for an emergency bail application, as the lower court that would hear the case was not operating.
COVID-19 was used as an excuse to get them remanded to prison. And COVID is still being used as an excuse not to bring them to court. If you look at a letter that was given to us by prisons authorities, they said that we cannot allow lawyers to access the prisons because of the current lockdown due to COVID-19. Now, no one was demanding for physical access. They could have given us access through the telephone. So that is just an excuse. They aren't doing what they're supposed to do, and in the process, they're violating rights.
The defendants have been charged with conducting an act likely to cause the spread of an infectious disease, namely COVID-19, which is caused by the coronavirus. Patrick Onyango, the deputy spokesperson for the Kampala police, says officers made the arrests after local residents complained about the gatherings.
They were not being targeted because they were gay. It was the community that saw that these people are violating the presidential directives and informed police. And these were more than 10. They were 23 in a number. So police had to act according to the directive and according to the law.
Ugandan authorities have outlawed any gathering of more than 5 people in an effort to stop the spread of the coronavirus. And police have been enforcing the rules, arresting more than 400 people last week for alleged violations. On Monday, the UN Human Rights Office, in a statement, said that any emergency response linked to COVID-19 must be proportionate, necessary, and non-discriminatory. They say that in Uganda, authorities are using their emergency powers to act arbitrarily. Frank Mugisha, executive director of Sexual Minorities Uganda, says many LGBT shelters have had to change their policies because of the crackdowns. The shelters sometimes house youths who have been kicked out of their homes by their families.
We've only had violations towards LGBT persons, especially towards the shelters from local councils and law enforcers in those areas. People have had even to shift or reduce on the number of people who are staying in certain shelters because of the law enforcers.
The 19 men will remain in jail until a court hearing on May 12th, unless the High Court grants them bail before then. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
In Nigeria, Africa's largest economy, businesses across the country have been shut down and offices and people are asked to work remotely from their homes. The shutdown has been especially hard on the wedding industry because of its dependence on crowds and physical gatherings. Ifeoke Tong reports from Jos, Nigeria.
Patience Ozohu is making up a bride in her hotel room, where she spent her last night as a single person. In 1 hour, she will be married. Ozohu has enjoyed a lucrative business in the Nigerian wedding industry as a beauty consultant for the last 20 years. But she says avoiding physical contact with her clients as protection against the coronavirus is difficult in her line of work.
Different textures of the products we use and the texture of our client's skin, we need to be able to gauge that so that we are not, goofing while we're doing our job. And a lot of thought goes into what we do. And if we are not able to touch and feel, okay, it poses a serious problem.
An average Nigerian wedding costs about $13,000, with high-profile weddings costing over $250,000. The industry generates tens of millions of dollars each year. Due to safety precautions over COVID-19, many of his businesses, like Yama Book's photography business, are facing challenges.
I have weddings that have been booked prior to the COVID-19 pandemic, and now we have to reshuffle appointments and bookings, and nothing is coming in. Clients are panicking. Some want to cancel, some want a reduction.
Just Event Center owner Nestor Lar says via Skype his business is also feeling the impact of the pandemic.
It has had a very devastating effect on us because the clients are not coming forth anymore because they couldn't cope with the 50 people stipulated by the government as the policy of the government, and with the social distancing of 2 meters per person. So it's been very challenging.
Most weddings in Nigeria are public and can have as many as 1,000 people in attendance. With the government banning public gatherings of more than 50 people, many couples like Herbert Daniel and his fiancée, Nyaksang Wapnang, have had to cancel their plans.
25th April will have been the day, but then looking at this, so we have to change everything.
The couple say the pandemic forced them to change all their arrangements.
I have to call all vendors that we've contacted already, from the people with the hall to have a new schedule, to people who will be supplying us with drinks, to people who will be cooking. Everything just changed with this pandemic.
Trying on her personal protective equipment for the first time, Ozohu is optimistic her company will find new ways to stay in business while maintaining safety precautions for herself and her clients.
I would have to use gloves. I would have to use a face mask. If possible, use a face shield, okay? So that even if I'm talking or the client is talking, there's little risk of cross transference. And as much as possible, sterilize as we move along.
Despite the restrictions over COVID-19, some couples across Nigeria have chosen love over the risk of contracting the virus. It gives hope to the wedding industry that they too will carry on. Ifyok Etang for VOA News, Jos, Nigeria.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, I'm Yehiyu Suhib in Washington, thanking you again for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bongo flavor to soukous, afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.